I'm going to tell you about the dynamics of elastic boundaries, and I'll get into what it is after I put up the outline. So in the beginning, what are elastic boundaries and why are we interested in them? Secondly, I'll tell you about the issues involved in modeling them. And third, I'll tell you some interesting dynamics which one observes after analyzing some equations and so on. And finally, I'll tell you about some more questions, lots more questions than answers. The talk is extremely qualitative. I have about maybe two equations, and it's probably even much shorter than an hour, so please feel free to interrupt. So firstly, what are elastic boundaries? Here is a sheet of paper. The boundary right here is an elastic boundary. The surface of a table is an elastic boundary. If I have an eraser sitting on the table, the surfaces in contact is an elastic boundary. So to understand friction, for instance, you need to understand how that boundary in contact behaves. The other thing I have is a sheet of paper. I can tear it. And this point right here is a crack going through the sheet of paper. And this point, again, is a boundary. So by boundary, I'm not just defining something that confines an elastic medium, but something that determines boundary conditions for the equations of elasticity. So in that sense, I'm even going to include dislocations and defects in solids as boundaries. And they, again, show very interesting behavior. Yet another example of a boundary is if I take this scotch tape and stick it on the surface of the table. If I had a much wider scotch tape, it's even more interesting. As I peel it up, this line of contact between the scotch tape and the table is a boundary. And we want to understand how these boundaries behave for reasons I'll get to. Before I go ahead, I should say that this is work done with various people, primarily Daniel Fisher, Jim Rice, Alex Lobkowski, who's in the audience, and a bunch of other people who have done numerics at various points. Okay, so suppose I have an ant sitting on the edge of the sheet, and I could listen to the sheet of paper tearing, but I couldn't quite tell what was happening. It would be of great interest for the ant, maybe, to figure out what exactly was happening on the sheet of paper. And it might not seem that important, but if I were a person with a stethoscope on an aircraft wing and I want to figure out where the thing's breaking, it's of much more importance. And even more importance is if I want to analyze seismic data. And from talking to geophysicists, what I find is it's extremely shocking at, I mean, what they're doing to invert these data. And I don't really trust anything. So I think there are very many interesting questions which have to be figured out in this area. More about analyzing where they've happened and so on. Yeah, more about where the earthquake will happen, more macroscopic analysis. And yet another set of questions is, I mean, if I have this table, or in earthquakes, for instance, most of the energy is carried by waves which are confined to the surface of the Earth. And one wants to understand how these waves travel on the surface of the Earth. And for instance, if I'm sitting at the bottom of a valley, is the energy focused in there? Am I in bigger trouble? A connected question is, in cell phones at Lucent, for instance, they're worried about how waves travel on the surfaces of chips which they use in cell phones. And there again, they're interested in how randomness affects the propagation of surface waves. So there are a whole bunch of questions on a whole variety of scales which one needs to understand. And the very nice part about this is that computers turn out to be not that useful because they're extremely difficult problems. And to get anywhere with computers, I mean, some of the results I'm going to tell you about, the analytic results, they had to verify using super-duper computers of some sort. And they could just about verify the bare minimum results. So there is lots of room for interplay between analytic results and computers rather than doing things right from computers from scratch. For instance, in fracture, there are lots of people who are doing simulations of solids breaking, which are 100 by 100 by 100 atoms in size. And even that takes lots of computational power. So there again, there's room for analytics. And then, as I said, one needs to understand how to invert data from seismograms and so on to understand how earthquakes happen. And that, again, I think is an open question. So these are the set of questions I'm interested in. And it's clear what elastic boundaries mean. And we are interested in the dynamics of these boundaries to understand these various problems. So what I'm going to tell you about now is the issues involved in modeling such problems. Firstly, if I take a rubber band, for instance, and distort it with a wave vector Q, you all know that the energy goes like, if phi is the displacement field of the rubber band, the energy goes like grad phi square. So in Fourier space, the energy goes like Q square. Right? However, if I take the sheet of paper again, and I distort the edges with a wave vector Q, the distortion travels into the sheet of paper. It's not just the edge I'm distorting. So in effect, if I distort the edge with a wave vector Q, there are distortions into the sheet up to a distance of 1 over mod Q. So in effect, these boundaries are much stiffer, and the stiffness goes like mod Q in these cases. And it's like Q square times 1 over mod Q, which is the width of the sheet. And in Fourier space, this will go like 1 over Z square. And this is a quantity you should remember, which will keep coming up later in the talk. The next big question again, which important is, if I hit the table, I have three kinds of waves in the table. Longitudinal waves and transverse waves in the bulk, and I also have surface waves which travel along the surface of the table. And vectorial elasticity is extremely important for these surface waves to exist. If, for instance, I confine the atoms on the table to move only in one direction, if they could move only up and down, then I would not have any surface waves. So vectorial elasticity is very important, and we will see again that for modes along boundaries, this plays a crucial role.
So
there are waves which decay exponentially in the bulk and travel with a characteristic velocity on the surface of the table. They're called Rayleigh waves. And they're in addition to the you have one set of waves in the bulk which travel this way and the atoms vibrate that way. The atoms vibrate that way. And the two conspire together given the Neumann boundary conditions on the surface, such that you have a new wave traveling on the surface of the table which decays exponentially into the bulk, which is neither transverse nor longitudinal. It's a linear combination of them. I mean, some kind of combination of them which satisfies the boundary condition. So...
And D
is
an equation there.
Z is a coordinate along the rubber band or... this is any coordinate. I'm just saying this is a Fourier transform of mod Q in one spatial coordinate. I'll get to what the coordinate system is and so on. And the third question is, what is the role of heterogeneities? All rubber bands are dirty, all solids are dirty, and solids on solids are even dirtier. So we need to understand how dirt interacts with these elastic waves. And the other problem is, these are all moving boundary condition problems, so they're ugly to begin with. And there is no way in which one can write out equations of motion for these boundaries. So the philosophy one adopts, at least we have adopted, is to write out an equation on some small length scale and look at larger and larger length scales, look at what terms are generated, and put them back in and see if they're relevant or not, and so on and so forth. So it's all in a normalization group sense that one looks at these. And again, if I have solid-on-solid friction, various people have been looking at all kinds of friction laws and complicated friction laws and so on, and I will not get into them. And just by putting in vectorial elasticity, one finds a whole bunch of very interesting features without having complicated friction laws of any sort. So for the bulk of the talk, lots of this goes through for lots of the boundaries I've been talking about, but I'll just focus on fracture. And I'll draw a diagram in a bit, but I have a solid which I'm pulling apart, and a crack's going through the solid. So I'll just specify what it looks like. Hope I can draw properly. So Z is the direction along the crack front. Again, this is the boundary, this is a crack front, and I'm looking at the dynamics of how this thing moves through the solid. This 1 over Z square is exactly this coordinate Z. So if I had a straight crack front, I'm drawing this crack front out here, if I took the origin and pulled it ahead by 1 unit, the force elsewhere at a distance Z from it would go like 1 over Z square. That would be the force it would experience pulling this point ahead. So we're going to look at the dynamics of this object, and the solid satisfies vectorial elasticity. So this is the first of the two equations in the talk. This is ui double dot is del j sigma ij. With the boundary condition that the normal stresses sigma in equal to 0 on the free surfaces. To begin with, I'll focus on a crack which lives on a plinth. So the surfaces it leaves behind are completely flat. And now we have to figure out how one gets at an equation of motion for something like this, given that the solid obeys Newton's equations. To do that, we have to figure out why the crack moves. So firstly, I have some stresses pulling it apart. And as the crack moves ahead, it relieves elastic energy. So you have an elastic energy flux to the crack tip. And on the other hand, as the crack moves ahead, it has to break bonds. So you need surface energy to create the crack surfaces that are left behind. And we postulate that the local elastic energy flux, which I call G, so I have an elastic energy, G, and a surface energy gamma, and we postulate that the equation, okay, so first let me get to the elastic energy G first. That's the local elastic energy flux to a point on the crack tip. And that in general, I should step back and say that the equation for the crack tip is given by x equals f of zt. This specifies the shape of this curve here. And the elastic energy flux in general is a function of the local velocity at the point z. It's a non-local functional of the shape of the crack. It's a function of the coordinates itself. And you can understand this non-locality, and it arises because of two reasons. One is this 1 over z square interaction. Even if I'm sitting far away on the crack, it knows what the shape is. And secondly, as the crack moves ahead, it emits sound waves. So something I emit here is going to come hit me somewhere else later on. So that gives me non-locality both in space and time. It depends on the velocity and the coordinates. And it has this interesting structure, actually, as an aside. You can separate this out into a part which depends only on the local velocity times some rest piece which depends on the non-local pieces. And the separation, again, you can understand, it's like special relativity, where the faster the crack goes, the smaller the region around the solid that knows that the crack's coming. So the smaller the available energy for the crack to go. So this phi varies from, and it'll be 1 when the crack is moving at the infinitesimally slowly, and it's going to be 0 when it's moving at the Rayleigh velocity. So this is the elastic energy flux. And the surface energy in general can depend on the position in the solid. And here I'm just having 2 coordinates because it's restricted to the plane. And the equation of motion is obtained by requiring that G equals gamma. And one can do look at nonlinear terms, see what terms arise, and put them in by hand later on. But I'll just look at this. Okay, so let me first, now I tell you some results about the dynamics, what one finds when one goes through something like this. Let me look at a crack which is described by f of zt equals some vt plus little f, where little f are the variations in the mean velocity of the crack. I mean, d little f by dt are the variations in the mean velocity of the crack. And these will be caused by disturbances in the solid, like a heterogeneity sitting somewhere. Okay? And let me linearize these equations. And what one obtains is an equation of motion of the sort df by dt equals integral j of z minus z prime t minus t prime f dot of z prime t prime plus f minus gamma, where f is related to the loads I'm applying far away. This is a two-dimensional integral over dz prime, dt prime, and t prime goes from infinity right up to t. And, of course, when t goes to infinity, this thing goes like 1 over z square, which is the static part. So eventually it decays to the static part. I'll just plot things of these. But let me just analyze the equation about a mean velocity state. And what one finds is very interesting. Let me plot d capital F by dt minus v as a function of z. And I'm going to give you snaps at various times. So this is the crack moving at a constant velocity. This quantity is 0. I'm just going to displace them in time so that it's clearer. So this is at t equal to 0. Let me say there's a heterogeneity sitting here. What happens is that the crack comes along. Right at the heterogeneity, it slows down a bit. And then it speeds back up again. However, the slowing down propagates along the crack. So you have a new mod. As a result of vectorial elasticity, in addition to all these modes, where you have a new propagating mode, this has some characteristic velocity CS in addition to everything else. And so you see that the crack is going to be much more sensitive to heterogeneities because you're sending out signals right along the crack in addition to all the other waves you're sending out. So this is an interesting thing which has been observed numerically recently by Jim Rice and company by doing numerics on some ball and spring models, three-dimensional models. What's even more interesting, what we find, yeah?
We're going to have a water wave.
Yeah.
And it goes past a rock. You see it pass in light.
No, that decays the power law in time. Oh, this doesn't decay at all. So it just keeps going, yeah. That decays, yeah. So.
But if you have a solid most type of expectations, that wouldn't decay also.
Yeah, but this is just a linear theory, isn't it? Yeah. This is just a propagating mode, like any wave equation. Okay, so what's even more interesting is when I allow the crack to go out of plane. So I don't restrict it to move in a plane anymore. I have surfaces which are left behind which are crooked. And here again we can write out equations of motion which I won't get into. And what one finds is even more interesting. Here is the x direction. Here is the z direction. I have a big bump sitting out here. The crack goes along and it goes out of plane to avoid this. And it's out of plane again produces a mod. This is again in addition to everything else that's present. So what you should see once you break the solid are these lines. And there are people in Israel who are doing experiments right now and they do see these lines. So, and again, one of the major mysteries, I mean, as I didn't mention any experiments. Most people have been breaking solids and looking at fractal dimensions of things, which I don't know. I think people are more careful now and they're looking at things like this before looking at fractal dimensions. There is some very interesting physics right here. Okay, so now I'm going to change gears and tell you about what happens when this V is zero. So I'm going to be near onset of motion. To do that, let me plot J, that's this kernel right here, as a function of time at a fixed Z. And this J seems to have a very interesting structure, again, because there are three elastic waves in the solid. This is zero. At the longitudinal wave velocity, which is the fastest, J actually goes negative. And then rises up, goes positive, and then decays to 1 over Z squared. So you have this funny structure. And what that leads to is interesting solutions to this equation. Oh, I can cover several pages of that, but I mean, okay. What one does is calculates this quantity G. One has to use these equations of elasticity, given some particular crack shape F, right, and compute the elastic energy flux to the tip with these boundary conditions. I mean, normal Green's function techniques don't work, and one has to devise other techniques to do it, but. You assume it, and then you do it self-consistently. So you evaluate the function G as a functional of capital F. Okay. Again, this particular form of J doesn't arise if you don't have vectorial elasticity. It arises in all these boundary problems, wherever you have vectorial elasticity, and I think I even have conditions for such a J to arise. And the solutions this permits, if I plot f dot as a function of z, I can get solutions where f dot is 0 and then some finite value determined by the load. And this step here moves with some characteristic velocity s. So I can have these kink solutions which move along the crack. The velocity s is determined exactly where the area under this curve vanishes. And one finds that as this guy starts moving, it makes stuck regions of the crack start moving. I have other kinds of solutions where this S goes the opposite direction. So this is stuck, this is moving. And as it goes this way, it makes the moving parts of the crack stationary. So you have these kink and anti-kink kind of solutions that move along the boundary. And this is true in elastodynamics, I mean in friction as well. So now what we do is look at what happens if I have this kind of one-dimensional elastic interface moving through a dirty solid. And so what I'm going to have now, for instance, I'm looking at a planar crack from top down. This is the plane of the crack. This again is the x coordinate, this is the z coordinate. This part of the solid is broken and it's moving up. And I have lots of heterogeneities. So what's going to happen is that it's going to get stuck at points where the regions are tougher, and I gradually increase the load. And then what happens, I've looked at movies of these and done more analysis, the part which is most weakly pinned gets unstuck. It sends out these kinks in both ways, and then it hits heterogeneities which are tough, which nucleate the opposite kink, comes back in, and locks in the avalanche. So eventually it moves into something of the shape. And there is a shape, there is a some size, characteristic size psi for this particular event. Now if I, so I have a crack, it's sitting happily there, I increase the load by a bit so that the most weakly pinned point jumps ahead. Okay. It jumps ahead, sends out these signals, right? And the stresses on everything else increases and it pulls those guys ahead too. So what happens is you have a kink, two kink solutions moving outwards, they hit the hard wall, become anti-kinks, move back, so these guys have already moved ahead by some distance by now. Oh, and then they get locked in.
Oh, what do you mean locked in?
So once the kink moves this way, these guys start moving at a finite velocity. And then another kink which goes this way comes back in and makes them stationary. So
I mean
they move with a finite velocity till the other kink comes and hits it.
Moves forward and then stops.
Yes. At the next, yeah.
Isn't your y is zero? I mean
your, yeah, this is the y equal to zero plane, yeah. The kink is in the velocity field, yeah. And it has a characteristic velocity of some sort. Okay. Now, let me tell you a wee bit about the case when there are no sound waves. If I look at the mean velocity of the crack as a function of the load, at a critical load, which I call FC0, what happens is that the velocity comes up linearly. When I don't have any of these effects of sound waves and all I have is this thing right here. These are just results I'm telling you about. So if I just had this shape right here, if it just went flat without any of the additional bump here or this lower down here. So it just goes directly to the 1 over z square with one sound velocity. In that case, what happens is that the velocity comes up gradually from zero. A lot is understood about these systems in terms of a renormalization group study. And one finds a second order like transition with the velocity as the order parameter, and there is a critical load at which this transition occurs. And at that load, you have diverging length scales, and the interface has self-affine structure, and so on. And one can understand the effects of these kinks around this critical point, and what one finds is that right up to a critical, some load, up to some load F, the size of these avalanches goes like FC0 minus F, raised to some capital minus nu, raised to some exponent minus nu. And as I approach FC0, in the absence of sound waves, this quantity would have diverged. So what's happening is that the avalanches get larger and larger till they span the whole system and everything starts to move. Okay? However, once you have these kinks and anti-kinks, what we find is that there is some critical value psi c up to which this happens, beyond which the whole thing runs away. So there is, and one can characterize the relevant quantities in some models for this quantity. And what one finds if you look at the distribution of avalanches as a function of the size, it has a power law up to some psi c. And beyond the psi c, one has system-wide events. And this apparently is seen in various single faults, earthquakes on single faults, this power law distribution up to a critical size beyond which everything runs away. So this is in one-dimensional systems. What we've also looked at is two-dimensional systems. This is sort of work still in progress. Not much has been done yet. And that's even more interesting. If I had this board sliding on the wall along here on the surface, again, I have a positive kink and a negative kink moving along at the same velocity. Right? So I can have a finite bound on which this interface is moving. And on top of this, we find kinks on kinks, where this guy can get locked in, and this moves along to another characteristic velocity on this kink. So you have this band moving and gradually getting locked in. So one of the big puzzles is how earthquakes stop, for instance. And what has been seen in some data is it hitting a tough spot and the whole earthquake locking in from that one spot. And maybe some such models, I mean, some such features such as vectorial elasticity are extremely important to understand them. And so far, all the inversion data don't account for vectorial elasticity at all. And all these features are absolutely generic. They arise in all these class of problems, at least in a whole lot of them. And so now we have no clue what happens once you have these things in two dimensions. In one dimension, I think we understand what happens, but in two dimensions with heterogeneity, is nothing much is known. And then again, this is what sort of started off with Jim Sethna. I mean, when you hear about these things, you think that all these problems would have been solved in the 19th century. But even a simple question like if I take a dislocation and distort it with a particular wave vector k, all the textbooks have the answer wrong. I mean, they miss log factors. And this is just for statics. So once you put in dynamics, pretty much nothing's being calculated. So I think there are a whole lot of questions to be answered. And thank you very much.
This is all continuum, right?
Yes, yes.
I missed the first few minutes of your talk, but you told me about it.
Yeah.
And to what extent does the atomistic structure matter? I mean, I would expect it to matter in a great deal. Right?
It does, it does. The problem is that, I mean, all these features here are relevant.
Right. I
mean, and the particular shape here depends on the atomistic features.
It's a relevant.
Yes, yes. But then, given the particular shape of the kernel, I can tell you what the... I mean, the generic solutions still go through, but the actual velocity s and so on would depend on the features.
But for example, the exponent.
I mean, this kernel would. What exponent?
Yeah, I mean, okay.
In the absence of sound waves, right. Lattice effects do not matter.
Okay, so let's talk about absence of sound.
Yes.
Okay. It doesn't matter.
No.
So that's
yes. Yes, I think.
Or it's a belief.
Let me see. No, actually, I cannot prove that. One does get locked behavior and all kinds of funny stuff. Yeah, yeah. But then once you have, I mean, if you have a perfect crystal, we're in trouble. But once I have a multi-crystalline solid with lots of grain boundaries and things, you might be back to. Yeah. No, if you break a mica sheet, things are very nice.
But in your once your sound waves. I mean, how do you incorporate the discreteness? I'm missing something. I mean, you agree that it's important.
We agree that it's important. And once you have discreteness, what's going to happen is that these things actually diverge here as square roots. However, I'm going to get microscopic response times for, if I'm sitting here on a lattice and the guy next to me has moved, the signal I see would depend on the lattice spacing. It would depend on my microscopic response time. That would set the shape of this curve.
But
at least.
Generic behavior
may be, I mean, yeah.
But that still remains to be proven.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, this is a whole.
But the point is, I mean, one nice feature is that there's propagating more along the crack front, for instance. Rice and company have done, I mean, broken ball and spring models which have beautiful lattice structure, and they still see the mod at exactly the velocity we look
some
for.
Numerical evidence.
Yeah, so there is hope, but.
So what is your picture about the deepening transition that maybe
so what happens is that
size equal for the finger grow
for what?
For the deepening.
Deepening, if I didn't have sound waves, I wouldn't see any of this stuff. Here, now what happens is that once the avalanche reaches a critical size, you have these kinks that just go through the whole system and zip everything. So I have a critical size up to which I'll still be dominated by the second order fixed point, beyond which I'll see.
Like psi c diverges.
No, psi c is fixed for a given j, and psi c will depend on the parameters such as these heights and the widths and so on.
So the deepening transition psi c remains finite. Or?
Yeah, it's like a first order transition where the velocity jumps directly, and yeah, you don't see the second order transition at all.
So what can you spot? I mean, v versus f.
Sure.
Zero and it jumps
up. So V versus F, this is in the absence of sound waves.
Yeah.
And in the presence of sound waves, it jumps up at much higher velocity.
Yeah.
and it goes directly this way. And small systems even show hysteretic behavior. It's not clear if hysteresis will persist if you have infinite systems.
So there's no saturation in D. I mean, for larger F, sound waves don't bring to some kind of saturation of D.
Yeah. A very large F. I mean, that we are looking at near threshold. Yeah. I mean, of course, the crack can't go faster than the Rayleigh wave velocity because I said this phi vanishes, so all those things kick in. This is at velocity is much less than the Rayleigh wave velocity, which is like 300 meters a second. So.
Obviously, you have your hands full, but in the related area of magnetic recording and magnetic hysteresis, once again, people worry about omega propagation. And there a whole new subfield is that what happens if you give a time dependence to your driving force, so it is not a constant force, but you increase it. In the case of hysteresis study, which is that you are zipping around your hysteresis loop. And in that case, for example, one gets non-universal exponents. These exponents continuously depend on the sweeping blade.
No, here there are no exponents. Everything jumps. I mean, this is in the absence of sound waves, but once you have sound waves, it jumps. In the case of magnetism, from what little I know, it seems like these domain walls wouldn't have any masses, or there are no, I mean, if the spins are overdamped, then you still see second-order-like transitions, so, yeah, so here you don't see that at all.
And what determines how strongly first order it is?
It's determined by the specifics of the shape of the kernel. And, I mean, we have some... we've looked at some model kernels which look like, the simplest ones are something like this. And there are various parameters, this height and that height and so on. And it depends very strongly on, this width here, the true sound velocities, and these various heights. So, I don't know if that information is very useful as far as real systems go.
What do the heights have to do with physically?
Physically, they'd have to do with the lattice spacing, they'd have to do with the microscopic response time. They'd have to do with the sound velocities in the solid.
Have to do with those things in a way that
are important.
And in a way that some is good.
That's no. But if for instance, there are people here who are doing simulations of solid-on-solid friction, and they can give me the plots of these kernels from scratch. They do something, give me the kernel, and then I can tell them what the kink velocity should be. So the absolute shape of the kernel determines in all these features. But given the shape, everything else seems to go through. Good question. In the case of friction, there are no nonlinear terms, so it's very easy, as long as linear elasticity is valid. In the case of fracture, nonlinear terms do arise. And again, this in-plane propagating mode I told you about does get destroyed with nonlinear terms, which we have looked at. However, these out-of-plane modes, these lines, are absolutely robust. They continue to survive. And one can get quite a bit about, And even if they don't survive, you should be able to see length scales on which you see signatures of them. So, and that seems to be seen.